This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Kenny Hsu. He's the president of the nonprofit Color Us United, which advocates for a race-blind America, and he's the author of An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. He's also a Robert Novak Fellow at the Fund for American Studies. Hsu is the son of Chinese immigrants, and he grew up in North Carolina and New Jersey. Some of the most interesting parts of his book retell his experiences grappling with failing to live up to model minority expectations. Just 24 years old, he writes passionately about the long history of legal discrimination against Chinese and Japanese in America, and what he says are increasingly harsh attacks on traditional definitions of merit and achievement that disproportionately hurt Asian Americans. He's an arch critic of Harvard's controversial admissions practices, which he says discriminate against Asians in an ill-fated attempt to pump up representation by Blacks, Latinos, and less deserving whites. He also talks about the role religion plays in his life and the life of the Asian American community more broadly. This is a fiery and intense conversation, and I think it's one you're going to find provocative and engaging. But before we get to the Reason interview with Kenny Hsu, I want to take a moment to talk about today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff, it's just clickbait and fake news that nobody should waste time on. So imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, and by that I mean positive stories, are highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories that you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. That service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go to Inkle.com/reason, they'll give you an additional 25% discount so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Kenny Hsu. Kenny Hsu, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. Well, let's start with An Inconvenient Minority, subtitled The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. Meritocracy is obviously a word that's very much in circulation these days. A lot of people are against it. But start by giving me the elevator pitch for An Inconvenient Minority. What is it about, and what are you hoping to accomplish by publishing it?
Yeah, well, I'm for the word meritocracy. And I think most Americans are too, which is basically the idea that you should be treated solely on the basis of your merit and your qualifications, not on the basis of arbitrary things like race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or anything like that. And we as a culture are deviating from that greatly. We are imposing new ideologies upon our populace, such as one popular ideology. I'm just going to call it critical race theory. Other people can call it systemic racism, et cetera. But the idea that, you know, America is a irredeemably racist country, and Asian Americans prove that that narrative is false. Because how could a minority, Asian Americans, right, who have been historically discriminated against, continue to face discrimination, continue to face hate, often come here with nothing, no generational wealth, are still able to succeed in this country? In fact, they have higher graduation rates of college than even white Americans, higher household incomes. And the reality is, it is because of culture. And you cannot talk about what's going on about race in this country without talking about culture. But sadly, that is a perspective that is being either vilified or ignored. And hopefully my book, An Inconvenient Minority, will bring that to light.
So let's start with a bit of autobiography, because your book talks a lot about things like, you know, Harvard admissions, as well as, you know, admissions in other places of higher education. But a lot of it is, you know, and other policy issues, but a lot of it is also autobiographical. Your family showed up here. Your father showed up here in 1991. You yourself, you're 24, so you're, you know, not that old or anything. But talk a bit about your life. Like, where did you come from? And what were the circumstances of you showing up here?
I am the child of Chinese immigrants. My father came to America in 1991. And he is a small businessman. And he wants to work in the financial sector. And he's, you know, building up his business to do that. I was born in 1997. And I was raised in Richmond, Virginia, and sort of when I was raised, right, we had gifted and talented programs. I went to the gifted and talented programs in my district, everything like that. And then we moved to Princeton, New Jersey when I was in 10th grade. And what I saw in Princeton was very interesting. You had these Asians in Princeton who would work so hard. Like, they would work hours and hours on end after school, extracurricular activities, studying, problem solving, everything like that. That would be every year you saw this, that would be denied admissions to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, everything like that. While the clearly more mediocre kids at our school would get into these same schools, despite the fact that everybody knew they were more mediocre. And
by mediocre, you mean they scored lower, or they had lower GPAs, lower class ratings.
Yeah, lower GPA, lower class rates. I mean, even things that students can understand, like even just like class attendance.
Yeah.
Or their contribution to a class discussion was noticeably less intelligent than you would otherwise think. So these kids would get in for a variety of different reasons. Some of them were children of Princeton professors because Princeton people lived there. So they got in because of that.
Right.
Others got in because of their race. I mean, and you knew that was the basis of the race because that was the case.
And so you yourself, you write about applying for admission to Princeton and getting rejected. Tell me, you know, I mean, you're laying out a case, and in the book you talk about how you say your family and more broadly Asian Americans buy into a basic model of America, which is that you know, you're here, you work hard, you excel at the things that you're told to excel at. You get good grades, you have high class rankings, you do all kinds of extracurricular activities, you play an instrument, you learn languages, you volunteer for, you know, helping old people or the poor or whatever. And then you get, you know, you don't get in to the places that everybody tells you you should be going to. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that and you know, what kind of feelings that kind of caused in you?
Well, so there's this idea of the American dream, right? And the American dream is very simple. It says it doesn't matter what country or what background you come from. If you come here, you will be treated on the basis of whatever your hard work produces. Your fruits. You won't be treated on the basis of that background. And that dream has attracted millions of immigrants every year, because often fleeing treatment on the basis of background, identity politics. Many Chinese immigrants came here fleeing the Cultural Revolution, which basically was treatment on the basis of background. You either were for the communists, you were a red, or you were a black. And those are classes in Chinese terminology, not race. And so now we have the same ideology here in America that's creeping up. And in my experience, and this is not, doesn't just pertain to me, but it pertains to the people that I interviewed that I talked about in my book, An Inconvenient Minority. The most damaging thing about something like Harvard's race-based admissions process to Asian Americans like me was there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. It's an incredibly demeaning philosophy, because I can't change my race. It's impossible to change my race. Now, one could say, well, you don't have to mark Asian on your college application, but it's foolish. Even if you don't mark Asian on your college application, Harvard knows that you're Asian. They have access to data mining services. They have access to consulting services that tell about your neighborhood, your race, your gender, all of those things. Doesn't matter if you market or not. So that's a misnomer that I need to get out right now. So there truly is nothing you can do about it if you're an Asian American, and that's completely antithetical to what the American experiment describes.
So do you, I guess two quick questions, you know, particularly from a libertarian perspective. One is that, you know, Harvard's a private college, Princeton's a private college. You know, do they have the right to discriminate however they see fit? And is your problem not that they have the right to do it, but that they're making a dumb decision or that they're being deceitful about it? You know, can we talk about that first?
Yeah. They're not, so Harvard takes like $500 million a year in government funding. So they're bound to the Civil Rights Act. So actually it is illegal for them to do this. Okay. It actually is unconstitutional.
So it's illegal for them to consider race or ethnicity in their admissions processes if they're bound by
federal. I would argue.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. I would argue. And so does Students for Fair Admissions, by the way, which is the group that's challenging Harvard.
Right. But which has basically lost at every level so far that it's been decided.
Well, it's at the foot of the Supreme Court right now. And in fact, the Supreme Court has taken a great interest to it because they actually issued a statement saying we want the Biden administration's thoughts on this process. Now, remember, I'll tell you why it is lost on the district level. And this is, I'm not even saying this is because the justice system is corrupt or anything like that. I'm not going to go about this far. You understand that the district and appeals courts are constrained by Regents of California versus Bakke. And which, for listeners who don't know, is a constitutional decision that says colleges can use race in admissions so long as it meets certain conditions for the sake of diversity.
Right, and as long as it's not the dominant factor.
As long as it's not the dominant factor. So basically, it gives colleges a free pass to say, look, we're not using race as a dominant factor, even though they are. And I can make that argument for you. In fact, I will. But just to finish up the story, judges and justices... And the Supreme Court is not constrained by this because they're the ones who made that decision. But judges such as Allison Burroughs, who decided SFS, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard in Boston, are constrained by this. So it does make the case a little harder, not a little, a lot harder for Students for Fair Admissions under those precedents.
Right. And there is also a case, a parallel case that Students for Fair Admissions is pushing with University of North Carolina, which has a publicly funded university. And I get your distinction that, you know, many private universities actually have far more, you know, public dollars going to them than state-assisted universities. But traditionally, the courts have ruled differently that, a private institution is one thing and a state-assisted one is different. So the UNC ruling might, you know, that might have a different outcome.
Well, one interesting implication of the Harvard decision is you're going to see, I think, the Supreme Court's distinction of public and private. You know, are there any truly private institutions anymore? If you're taking so much government funding, if you are doing all of that, if you're getting all of the benefits, you should be constrained by the laws.
Yeah, that, and I can tell you from a strict libertarian perspective, I totally understand that argument, and I'm a little bit worried if, you know, if you take $1 of government money, you are bound by whatever the federal government says is a disturbing kind of precedent to be set. In any case, though, can you say why, other than the fact that you, or Chinese Americans are at the losing end of this quest for diversity, is there really not a case to say that, you know, a Harvard or any college is actually served by having a mix of different people at the school? Obviously, Harvard is an example where the early quotas were levied against Jews, and then, you know, that gave birth to this workaround, which was, well, what we really want is geographic diversity. And because, you know, once you get outside of New York, particularly in the early 20th century, once you get outside of New York and you say, well, we want to take people from all over the country, that meant you were going to limit the number of Jews who were going to be admitted.
Yeah,
but
so
is diversity, is racial and ethnic diversity, geographic diversity, income diversity, aren't those good values for a university to kind of build into their freshman classes?
Well, number one, in response to your public-private argument, I would say at the very least, you would acknowledge that the $500 million that is being accepted by Harvard is at stake. which is nothing to sneeze at.
Right. Although it's also true that they absolutely could forego that. I mean, this is what, you know, a gigantic corporation.
Yeah, if they want to become entirely like a Hillsdale or Grove City. Which potentially. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the diversity argument. Yeah. So I've heard this argument many, many times. And first of all, the evidence is suspect that diversity truly helps a student body. Because when you say diversity, people get this idea like, oh, a whole range of perspectives, everything like that. And maybe that's helpful under certain situations. But what they really mean is race. That's what they mean. Diversity is essential. That means we want to use race in admissions. And there is no evidence out there really to suggest that this is the case. And not only that, there's evidence out there to suggest that when you're compromising meritocracy, it actually hurts the culture of the school. It doesn't help it.
How does it do that?
You admit, so even if you even if you bought that racial diversity has some marginal effect on helping students, it is significantly outweighed by the effect of less of admitting significantly less qualified students into the student body, because it affects the teaching. Because now you have to teach to the middle, or you have to teach to the bottom. And so the higher qualified kids are going to get affected, and everybody loses.
Yeah. To bring it back to Princeton, you applied to Princeton, and you were, in the book, you talk about kind of being depressed and discouraged and pissed off. Talk a little bit about, you know, how that felt.
Well, I wasn't the one who was depressed and discouraged and pissed off. But my friend Sam, who I interviewed, did actually get depressed and discouraged.
Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I was pissed off. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's, you move on with your life.
Yeah.
And I only revisited this college admissions thing in my third year at Davidson College when I saw the Harvard case come to national attention. Yeah. Somebody needs a story about this.
Right.
Because nobody talks about the Asians who are rejected from college admissions because they there's no sympathy for them. People get the sense, oh, they'll take care of themselves, but they don't realize the competition culture that it raises upon these Asian Americans, these ordinary Asian people who have to work 120% as hard as the average person because they know that they're going to be discriminated against. And I go around and I tell this story to when I talk to Asian American audiences about my book, and I say, Harvard is discriminating against you. You have to get 440 points higher on the SAT to have the same chance of admission as a Black person, 150 points higher as a white person, 300 points higher than a Hispanic person. And I just lay out the evidence. And let me tell you the dominant response. The dominant response I get is relief, because at last, someone's actually saying it. Because before, they were caught in this trap narrative that, oh, Harvard's not really discriminating against you. It still kind of is on you. And then when they see this trend, it's like completely doesn't comport with their senses. And so they finally get the truth and the reality. And I think that that's the service that I'm doing to the Asian American community.
Ken, you know, you mentioned Davidson College. You talk about in the book how you got a free ride to Davidson, and you ended up really flourishing there. In a way, isn't that an example, though, of a happy outcome? Because you ended up in a place that really nourished you, and that, I mean, you're 24 years old, you're in charge of Color S United, a group that we're going to talk about in a little bit. You've written a book. You are, you know, you're doing really well. Is it also the case that, you know, and this is particularly true of immigrant groups, they come to America and they immediately look at certain kinds of status indicators? You know, they want their kids to be lawyers. They want their kids to be doctors. They want their kids to go to an Ivy League school or something equivalent. And that's actually kind of a narrow understanding of what a meaningful life is, what a happy life is, and what a successful life is. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, Is it a bad thing you didn't get into Princeton? Is it a bad thing that maybe Asian Americans are, you know, going to broaden what they consider success?
I don't know if it's a bad thing if I got into Princeton or not, because I'm not Dr. Strange. I'm not in charge of 46 million different futures. But I will say this, two things. One, good end outcomes don't justify poor means and bad discrimination. So yeah, a lot of the Asians go on and do well. Some of them don't. Some of them do.
Mm-hmm. I personally, some of the ones who get into, you know, elite schools,
some of the ones who get into Ivy Leagues do well and don't. Yeah. But they don't justify poor means. They don't justify explicit discrimination. That is a principle. That means it's a side constraint upon our moral behavior. Two, even if we bought that college applicants who don't get into Princeton and the Ivy League still end up doing well, which, by the way, there is some evidence to show that if you're qualified intellectually to get into these schools, but you don't get in, you're still going to do all right.
I mean, there's evidence. Yeah, there's a pretty good evidence that it's more important what schools you could get into rather than what schools you actually attend.
Well, to me, that would make the case for discrimination even less credible, because at that point, then what's the point of discriminating? Right. You have to have a reason for discrimination, especially on the basis of race. And now you're not even saying, well, we're giving these guys a leg up, these Black and Hispanic kids a leg up, because you're not even giving them a leg up, because they would have gone to a place that would have served them. See, the truly, truly despicable thing about Harvard's race-based admissions process is the faithlessness they show to the U.S. education system. Because this is an institution so arrogant to believe that they have to be the ones to be the moral arbiters of race in society, and they have to be the ones to elevate these people, because God forbid these kids go to
UMass Amherst or something,
you know, or Amherst instead of Harvard.
Yeah,
you know, that's the truly arrogant and despicable thing about this.
So, I looked at Princeton has made a habit recently of publicizing their stats, the demographics of their incoming class. And for the class of 2025, they talk about how about 50% of the incoming class are people of color. About 21% are Asian. Asians make up 6% of the population. You know, what's your estimate of you know, what proportion of the incoming class of Princeton, if it was done on a straight, you know, kind of scores-based thing, a meritocratic thing, you know, by your definition, what do you think the percentage of the incoming class of Princeton or Harvard would be?
Yeah, well, it's not my estimate. It's Harvard's estimate. Harvard's own Office of Institutional Research revealed in 2013 that if there was no discrimination on the basis of race, that Asian Americans would make up 43% of Harvard. That's Harvard's numbers, not my numbers. Now, I'll give you a few numbers, and people might say, well, do we really want Harvard to be 43% Asian? But it's not about race at that point. At that point, it's about, hey, actually, who are the top scorers in this nation based on SAT scores, to a lesser extent grades, but SAT scores? SAT math scores are the scores above 700, 50% Asian, 42% white, like 3% Black, and maybe 5% Hispanic. And by the way, for those of us who really care about Black achievement in this country, like I do, that is a sad thing. That is something we need to improve. But you're not going to improve it by admitting students who are simply not as qualified for these top math and science programs in the nation into a program in which they're eminently not qualified for. And then you see actually that when students do get admitted because of these policies, they actually have higher rates of dropout, they have lower graduation rates, they get lower grades, and they fall behind, and they tend to get discouraged.
By the same token, to complicate that, there's no question that the 4 and 6 year graduation rates of Blacks coming out of Harvard or elite schools are much, much higher than the percentage coming out of a more middle of the road, either private or public university. So,
well, I can explain that through two things. Okay. One is the cascade effect. So first of all, there are top qualified Blacks and Hispanics in this country. Don't get me wrong. There really are genuinely top qualified Blacks and Hispanics in this country. They just happen to take a lower proportion than the top qualified Asians and to a lesser extent whites in this country. And so Harvard and Princeton has the capability to admit the top qualified ones, while the second tier and third tier schools don't get them. And so you're having in those second tier and third tier schools, Asians with scores of 700, 750 and above on the math SAT next to Black and Hispanic students with scores of 500 or 600. So that's that enables Harvard to sort of conceal that a little bit.
Have you?
I forget my second point.
Okay. So well, ahead. Have you? You know what? When you talk to audiences or people who are African American or Latino, you know, how do they respond to these kinds of arguments? Are they like, you know what, screw you, or you know, we don't care, or are they like, yeah, this is a problem?
I mean, they're largely sympathetic. There are some progressive Black Americans who say the SAT is racist, which we can talk about, but to a large extent, they understand the problems that are going on in their educational communities. This is a very dispiriting statistic, and you have to tell the truth about these things, because if you don't tell the truth, then people build their politics off of lies, and you don't want to build politics off of lies. The truth is the racial achievement gap between whites and Blacks in this country has not closed in the past 40 years. Whites score about 110 points higher in the SAT than Blacks did in 1980. They score about 110 points higher than Blacks do currently in 2021. That is a travesty, and that is a failure of the education system, and people recognize that and they want to solve that. So we have to collaborate and come together. And I think the Black population that I talk to really do recognize that.
Can we talk a little bit about this category of Asian Americans? You know, so Asian Americans or people of Asian descent make up about 6%. When you look, you know, this is an impossibly broad category. If it's even broader and kind of less meaningful in a lot of ways than talking about people of European descent, you know, because it covers everybody from South Asians, from Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis to Chinese and Japanese people. How comfortable are you with that group, with the idea of saying Asian Americans? Because, and there's such a, you know, different outcome based on, you know, whether you're from the Hmong tribe of Cambodia or you're from Japan or you're from, you know, certain parts of China. Or, you know, Indians actually have among the highest per capita and household income in America.
Well, there's only two quick characteristics that I can pretty confidently, in fact, that I can very confidently say describe a broad base of Asian Americans. One is commitment to education. And this is pretty true about every Asian group that comes in, with like only a couple exceptions. And there's a commitment to education. That may stem from the immigrant experience, but also stems from, in some cases, selection, or in other cases, just the fact that you come here and you have no money and no generational wealth. And how are you going to get ahead? Well, it's going to be education. And then two, they have an emphasis on family. And Asian Americans who come here have a strong emphasis on family. In fact, they have higher two-parent family rates than the average American, including the average white person. They also have lower drug use and lower crime rates.
Well, they have a higher per capita as well as household income than white Americans or
that probably, and those factors are the factors that eventually cause them to have higher household incomes than white Americans. Mm-hmm. It's culture. Go ahead.
Yeah. So talk about the culture. So broadly, I mean, even people from, you know, Bangalore to Tokyo, on some level, I mean, they're Asian because they share a commitment to education and to family.
Well, they're not Asian because they share. Mm-hmm. They're Asian because they come from the continent of Asia. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not the kind of person to generalize. As you can see, I try to get very specific. Yeah. But the only reason why I say like the term Asian American is because I could point out certain cultural aspects that are linked to Asian Americans that those are the things that I actually want to talk about, is commitment to education, family values, because those are actually available to people of any race.
Right.
Before we continue with the recent interview with Kenny Hsu, I want to introduce you to BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, one of the podcast sponsors. Are you feeling stressed out, run down, anxious, short-tempered? If you are, take the time to take care of yourself by going to betterhelp.com/TRI for the recent interview and start talking to a licensed therapist who's not going to judge you, but they will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. That's betterhelp.com/TRI. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone,
and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with a therapist in under 48 hours. If you don't like your first guy or girl, you can switch to another, all without the hassle of driving across town and sitting in a waiting room. I know it's a great service because I used BetterHelp.com myself. It really helped me out. If you need to talk it out, and these days I think we all do, go to BetterHelp.com/TRI and get 10% off your first month. And now, back to the recent interview with Kenny Hsu.
You know, one of the, I think, most compelling parts of your book is actually when you kind of go through the historical discrimination that was faced by Asian Americans. And in the first part, you know, in a weird way, Indians come later to this because, kind of technically they weren't able to be citizens here until after World War II, really. But you talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act, as well as the, various kinds of immigration acts against Japanese, but then, you know, most infamously and notoriously, the internment. Why are Asian Americans patriotic? In a strange way, I mean, they have certain, you know, they have almost as strong a case against America as African Americans or Native Americans. Where does your optimism about America come from as a Chinese American? Because, you know, this is a country that in the 19th century and more recently than that treated Chinese and Japanese and Asians generally just, you know, really with the worst forms of de jure kind of racism and discrimination.
Well, Asian Americans are patriotic in the same way that African Americans are patriotic, which is 55% of Black Americans in the latest report say that they are very or highly patriotic, and Asian Americans is even higher than that. So I'll tell you the reason why, you know, a lot of Asian Americans love America, because fundamentally, and I get that we don't always live up to the high expectations that we put upon ourselves, but we do have a tradition in America of the American dream, which is, actually, we are going, you know, we actually will not try to treat you on the basis of your background, and we will actually try to treat you on the basis of your hard work. So it's the meritocratic underpinning of the American dream that Asian Americans believe in, because they know that with practice, they can transcend their circumstances. And I'm going to get a little philosophical here, but even Mao Zedong, who mass murdered, you know, tens of millions of Asian Americans, of Chinese people.
Yeah.
Even he said, even he was able to draw from the text of Confucius, where on practice and contradiction, where practice, hard work, you know, discipline, self-discipline, all of those were internalized into these cultures from the very beginning. And so that's where we draw that from. In America, is the country that best gives them the opportunity to express that in creating a value system for themselves and others.
Yeah. An inconvenient minority. You talk about the stereotype of Asians as model minorities, but more specifically as kind of passive people who follow orders and, you know, go along with the group. Talk about your experience with that kind of stereotype, and do you see that ending? What's driving that? Or what might drive America to have a broader understanding that there is not one type of Asian personality? Because this goes to the claims against Harvard. The big thing came that the place where admissions officers could say, well, you know, these people are brilliant, but they're not really Harvard material because they're kind of dull or they're kind of uninteresting or they're like robotic, again, playing into various types of stereotypes. What's going on there? And you yourself don't fit into that. You talk about it in the book about how you weren't that interested in math and science and things like that that get associated with Asianness. You were interested in writing and other things.
But I eventually became a math major, not because I was interested in math inherently, but because I was competent at it. And I decided to choose the major, at least in my early part of college, before I before I got this book contract, I decided to choose a major that could actually project a stable income, you know, going throughout, which I think is a great thing. It's a good strategy. Look, there are deeply held stereotypes about Asian Americans, for sure, by some people in society. And I'm not just talking about whites, I'm talking about blacks too. And I'm talking about Hispanics. I talk about the stereotypes Asians hold against blacks and stereotypes Asians hold against whites too. I mean, people say racism is just a white thing. No, it's definitely not. But the one of the stereotypes that I talk about in my book, An Inconvenient Minority, was the idea that Asians are like it was popularized during the period of Chinese exclusion by the labor leader, Dennis Kearney, who was jealous of the Asian Americans performing more productively at the gold mines in California than the Irish people that he was with. So he installed a political stereotype against Asian Americans as being, they're worse than slaves, you know, they're just obedient and, you know, and just full of horrible, I would say they just beg, they sit and beg and they don't ever complain and everything, like they're like robots. And so I think that there's a remnant of that stereotype in our culture today. But I think the number one way that continues to be internalized in society is through the Harvard admissions process, is through the Ivy League admissions process, because Harvard's admissions process gives legitimacy to this stereotype. The way that they rate Asians lowest on personalities, which you sort of touched on, but they do. They rate Asians lowest on personality. They rate people in three things: academics, extracurriculars, and personality. And they rate Asians lowest, despite the fact the alumni interviewers rate them the highest. So where do they get this from, if not from a deeply held stereotype against Asians? It's very sad.
Do you think, as you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm assuming that you're probably a majority, because the number of Asians coming into the country over the past 30 or 40 years has vastly increased, particularly when you count South Asians in that. Do you think, as Asians are in America longer, that they will become, you know, in the same way that, in 1900, people would say, well, Jews were all like this, or Italians were all like this, Irish were all like this. You don't really see that in the same way anymore. You know, partly as immigrant groups come here and they acculturate and they assimilate, or rather as America acculturates to them and they assimilate to America, there's more opportunity for treating people of particular descent as individuals rather than as markers of old forms of kind of cultural discriminatory identity.
Yeah. Look, Amy Chua, who I quote in my book, said
she's not helping the Asians as academic grind models, right? That yeah. only care about one goddamn thing, like where you go to college and then where you get a job, right?
Yeah. Her parenting style, you can question it, everything like that. But she said, you know, there is a sort of indignance of Chinese towards American culture sometimes, in the sense that maybe their assimilation to America is a bad thing.
Right.
When I talk to Chinese Americans about this, and people get really, they start to really hate America about this, I say, look, in life, do you want to be treated as, or do you want to continue to impress upon your children that this country is going to, you know, demean them and destroy them, even as you live in this country? The reason why we have a culture is because people thought it would be valuable to pass on cultural elements to further generations. And Asian Americans, even though we have learned, you know, some really important things, that we have a lot to show America, we can also learn from America. You know, the quarterback mentality is something I talk about in my book in America, and a lot of Asians sort of demean it. But there is value in being assertive. There is value in political organizing, which Asian Americans have not been really good at until recently. And I am part of the renaissance of that. But there is value in America. You have to look. There is value in American culture. And I think just like people have a lot to learn from Asian Americans about the value of studying and hard work and discipline, Asian Americans have a lot to learn from America on other things.
Well, you know, America, going back to its earliest origins, you know, European America anyway, you know, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, within a generation or two, the Puritan forefathers were begging their children to be as religious. The kids were like, fuck it, we're not going to church as much. And there was something called the Halfway Covenant, where the elders were just begging younger people to be half as religious as they were. It's in the DNA of America that, you know, immigrants show up here and then their kids start, you know, really being raised in a different planet, much less a different country. And it's true that, you know, when you get to second, third, fourth generation of Americans, rates of criminality, rates of, you know, school, all sorts of things start to, you know, become more average, regardless of where you start. So we'll certainly be looking forward to that. Let's talk a little bit about Color Us United. Talk about this group that you lead. What is its, you know, what are its aims and what are its main activities?
After I got the contract for the book, my book, An Inconvenient Minority, and I started publicizing it, and then I was participating in some campaigns in California. There was a campaign there that Proposition 16 was on the ballot, which was, we're going to allow racial preferences in employment and public contracting.
Yeah, right.
And I was on the no on Proposition 16. So I opposed, of course, racial preferences, which I always have. I was on there, and after I gained some experience there, I was, in effect, I was recruited to be the first president of Color Us United by my board. And Color Us United, weird organization, what we do is we fight against the racial division, critical race politics that are infecting our institutions. So we conduct institutional guerrilla warfare, just like, you know, Students for Fair Admissions is suing Harvard, doing a lawsuit, getting rid of their race-based policies. We employ a variety of tactics and means to speak for the ordinary American who is tired of these race-based policies harming them in their lives.
Right. Your slogan is for Color Us United is advocating for a race-blind America. Who are your members? Who is your audience?
Well, our audience, which is different from our members,
okay,
we're not a membership-based organization. We're a professional organization. We're actually quite small, but we may talk about some of the impact we're doing shortly, which is in the news right now. But the our audience is the American who, the employee of a company. If you're an employee of a company, Fortune 500 company or something, or an institution or a college, and you are seeing a race-based policy being unfairly leveled upon you, either DEI trainings, anti-white trainings, or
DEI is diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. Diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings that are anti-white, or, you know, certain policies that promote less qualified people over you in the name of solving racism or everything like that. And you feel that you can't speak out, come to us and we will look into it and we potentially could be your voice.
So some of the groups that you work with are FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Economics, Speech First, the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they kind of do similar things where they'll help people, or when they hear about a case, they'll bring something to bear. Talk about the your petition that is directed at the Salvation Army, which is going through a Let's Talk, or is enacting a Let's Talk About Race policy. Can you talk about what the Salvation Army is doing and then what your petition is trying to achieve? Because that seems like a good encapsulation of what Color Us United is about and how you go about trying to affect change.
Yeah, I would say yes to, we work with those organizations, but we are also very different. Because we're the ones who actually organize the employees within the institutions that are going woke. So we're actually in the process of organizing. And this Salvation Army petition, which you mentioned, is a big target. Right now, the Salvation Army has been engaging in a Let's Talk About Racism initiative that was endorsed by their highest ranking official, their general. And before George Floyd, but really accelerating since George Floyd, they've been implementing these massive DEI campaign policies that are really targeting their own officers and that, of course, don't solve one single inner city problem in the schools. And so Colorist United, we've organized 14,000 employees and donors of the Salvation Army to fight back and say no to all of this. And we're pushing for a very simple goal.
So, you know, yeah, what is that goal? Is for them to pack in the Let's Talk About Race policy, or, you know, is it to replace it with something else, or, you know, what do you hope to achieve?
Commander Hodder, who is the national commander of the Salvation Army USA chapter, we want you to renounce critical race theory, renounce Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi, who you quoted in Let's Talk About Racism, abolish your DEI trainings, and stop saying that America is a racist country, because those are the Americans that are actually contributing to your organization, primarily for your benefit. How insulting is it to do that? So that's what we're pushing for, and we know that they're listening.
Why do you think, you know, the Salvation Army is it's a religious organization, it's a private charity, but it's similar to a lot of corporate America, which I think people both on the left and the right and in the libertarian center have been kind of shocked at how easy it has been to kind of go after, you know, large universities, corporations, nonprofit groups, and kind of get them to take on a, you know, a CRT-ish or a woke activism mode. Why do you think corporate America and other large institutions fell so easily to these, you know, kind of programs or campaigns by people to say, no, you've got to start teaching DEI stuff and you've got to start following people like Robin DiAngelo, Ibram X. Kendi, you know, and the like?
Yeah, so the woke have gotten a head start, for lack of a better word. So what happened was that in the 70s, you had these affirmative action policies that basically said, we're going to implement certain racial quotas in our companies and things like that. And they hired administrators to basically implement affirmative action. But then Reagan administration in the 80s said, no, that's actually too much federal regulation. We're going to drop that. Well, the administrators, the affirmative action compliance administrators, suddenly realized, well, they have no job anymore. And if there's anything the bureaucracy loves to do, it's to expand the bureaucracy, as Isaac Asimov said. And these people transform themselves. They transform themselves right before your eyes into what? Diversity consultants. And the diversity industry popped up because at the same time, you had Regents of California versus Bakke passed. And so since the 80s and the 90s, you've had this budding DEI diversity industry that has leveraged the, you know, some of the real fears that are going on about racism in this country to push their own agenda within corporations. And so what you see now is this late stage blossoming of DEI in companies just being extra aggressive, especially since the death of George Floyd, to push this narrative so they can provide themselves maximum benefit and justification to exist and get promoted.
You know, at you're 24, I think that technically makes you a Zoomer, right? A member of Generation Z?
I kind of like right in between.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, you're a young American, let's say. People your age, of your cohort, seem to be much more critical of America, to view America as a racist, a homophobic, a anti-feminist kind of place. What do you think is driving that belief, you know, that America is racist, is misogynistic, is homophobic, you know, and getting worse at it? When, you know, I think most people my age, and I'm more than twice as old as you, look at the past 50 years and say, you know what, things have gotten remarkably better along most lines in terms of inclusiveness and just, you know, not holding on to old kind of atavistic hatreds and things like that. Why are younger people so convinced that America is a fallen nation?
Yeah, among all objective analyses, you're absolutely right. America has gotten significantly better since the 60s. We've gotten astonishingly more colorblind. In fact, a 2015 Washington Post survey said that 94% of Americans 94%, have zero problem living next to a neighbor of a different race. And you might say, oh, well, that conceals a lot of implicit bias against people. But in that same survey worldwide, you had much more explicit condemnation of people of different races. In China, that number was like 75%. India was less, South Korea, Germany less, France less. America is. So even when the explicit numbers decline, that's how you know America is still at the peak of colorblindness in the world, at the very least. But people are being taught that America is still a systemically racist country. You guys, people need to understand, your listeners should understand, there are interests that benefit from the ideology that America is a systemically racist country. If America is an exclusive country, then DEI consultants win because they justify their role. They say, now we need more DEI. Who else wins? Well, academics, because academics need to push certain ideologies and they need to continue to get published. And this provides an easy way for them to get published. Racism is this. Racism isn't found in here. Racism isn't found in there. Easy way to get published. It benefits certain politicians that pander on identity politics. You understand that this has become a bureaucracy. This has become a corporation, sort of a corporate phenomenon now. And so that's why it's being peddled.
You are quite religious. You end the book with a citation of, I think it's Romans chapter 12, verses 3-8. Could you explain what that is, and then also talk about how your religion informs your worldview and your activism?
Yeah, well, Romans 12 is all about the pattern of the world versus the pattern of Christ. And I'll tell you the way that my faith informs my view on meritocracy. People might think meritocracy is very harsh. And there's some truth to that, although I'm not going to admit that that's totally true because I don't think it's that harsh. But I don't derive my worth from my so-called works. I don't derive my worth from how qualified I am or how capable I am or how much money I make. I derive my worth from being made in the image of God, just like everybody else. So it's that actual central equality that allows me to say, because I know I and you and everybody else are inherently worthy under God, then I can fight for the ideology, or I can fight for the philosophy that best enables human flourishing in this world, because I'm not concerned about those my objective worth and where I actually come from. Mm-hmm.
So you find in Christianity or in your version of Christianity, a real emphasis on equality. You know, we're all equal under God, and hence, you know, temporarily, you know, we should all be equal under the state. We should be equal under the law.
Yeah, that I would argue is part of the American tradition.
Sure.
And the American founding. Right. But yes, it is a fundamentally Christian idea to believe in the equality of all mankind under God.
So what is the role of private institutions versus public ones in a world where, you know, if we are all, you know, set loose to do our best based on our, you know, God-given talents or human-developed talents, there's going to be a wide range of outcomes. Do you see in your world that it would be private charities and, you know, religious organizations or other kind of intentional or mission-based groups that would help people that really aren't up to the challenges of the world or who need help for particular reasons? What does your worldview imply for kind of the size, scope, and spending of the government versus the private sector?
Yeah, well, I'm not on the most libertarian of ends. I think there is a role of government in providing for one, basic needs, because I believe in an equal opportunity state. Mm-hmm. I believe, of course, in the value of public education, although that's coming under severe threat right now. But that's a different topic. But I believe in the role of government to provide for public safety. I believe in a graduated income tax, too, to facilitate some of that. But ultimately, the problems of poverty, here's my issue. The problems of poverty aren't going to be solved by you throwing money at them. And by the way, history has told us time and time again that that is the case. I mean, we spend three times as much on public education as we did 40 years ago to produce exactly the same scores and results as we have 40 years ago. So if you want to use government money, I believe in limited government. I believe you have to use it in such a way where you're incentivizing people to become productive on their own, especially healthy, able-bodied people, rather than trying to set the wrong precedent for them early on in life.
Do you generally follow, like, and I did, I'm thinking about this particularly in K through 12 education then, you know, and I happen to agree with you that there's a role of for the state in educating, not in educating people per se, but giving people the means by which they can fully participate in society, which could include giving them money to spend on school the way that they want to. I mean, so would you, generally speaking, the aid that goes from the government to people would be given to them in a way where they get to choose how to spend it in order to kind of maximize their potential or to actualize themselves?
Yeah, like a voucher system? Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I would. Yeah. There's a, I would say that you would have to moderated in a sense with high standards, no question. I think that I want agreed upon standards upon which you should do that. But the modern homeschooling movement has done a very good job of that. In fact, you know, homeschool kids, I think right now in some states are like half a grade higher in terms of test scores and reading and writing abilities than regularly schooled kids. So I don't have a problem. I believe that that will eventually work itself out.
I always worry about the bullying situation in homeschooling. You know, it's if it's happening, it's going to be really intense, right?
Well, there are you're right. There are unique problems, but there are also, by the way, some serious problems about. It's hard for me even to talk about this, but there's going to be an article that I'm going to release very soon on an outlet of significant carriage on some of the pedophilia problems in some of these public schools as well, and everything like that. So especially in communities where they're least likely to speak up, where they're most likely to, you know, either because of undocumented status or low income or everything like that. So I'm going to say, yeah, there's a room to be cleaned up in homeschooling. Yeah, but there's definitely room to be cleaned up in public schooling.
For sure. I think we're going to leave it there. I've been talking to Kenny Hsu. His book is An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. Where is the best place to find your, I mean, we know the book is in bookstores and at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere. Where's the best place to go to follow your writing?
You should follow me on Twitter, where I post all of my writing at Kenny M. Hsu. Same thing with Instagram at Kenny M. like Mary Hsu, X-U. You can go on inconvenientminority.com to get a sort of a sampler of my writing. And really just go on colorusunited.org, sign up for that newsletter where you're going to get more of my writing and also get a sense of what we're doing to bring back our culture from divisive race-based policies.
Great. We're going to leave it there. Kenny, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hey, thanks, Nick.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can make it easy on yourself by going to reason.com/podcasts and signing up there. Thanks for listening.